Let's do it now.
Turn up the volume nice and loud. Because we are controlling transmission with dance beats and R&B. Hurry. You're in the mix with Lil Drummer Girl.
With your host,
Dawn Marie.
Hey there, welcome to tonight's episode of Little Drummer Girl. It's Dawn Marie Mutel here, and today's guest is the ultimate guitarist, Larry Mitchell. Larry is a Grammy award-winning producer, engineer, and performer who has toured the world playing guitar with artists like Tracy Chapman, Billy Squier, Rick Ocasek, and Miguel Bosé. Larry has released 8 solo records and won a San Diego Music Award for Best Pop Jazz Artist, and he is currently touring and promoting his latest release, The Traveler. As a producer, Larry has won 26 New Mexico Music Awards in various categories from pop, adult contemporary, rap, rock, country, and Native American. Let's welcome Larry to the show. Hey, Larry, how's it going this evening?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for being here tonight.
Yeah, thank you. It's good to catch up after many years.
I know, and it was so great to see you perform here in Florida at that wonderful venue there, and it was like a flashback. It's been so many years since I had. It was so great to see you, and the show was awesome.
Thank you. Thanks for coming out. Yeah, I like coming down. That was in Dunedin. Since the first time, maybe almost 3 years ago, we've come down to Dunedin and had a great time and just loved that area down in Clearwater and Tampa and stuff. So.
I'm psyched that you're here now, so I can just, like, you know, keep an eye out for you when you're in town. You gotta give me a hoot and let me know. So tell me, Larry, how young were you when you first started playing guitar?
Playing guitar at 9 is when I first actually got a real guitar and started playing. And that was after my mom threw my drum set out the window. I play drums now, but couldn't do it.
Oh, cool. I did not know that.
Yeah,
awesome.
And a lot of records I produce, I play almost all the instruments.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that. So that is just awesome. Did something inspire you to begin playing the drums? Let alone then to the guitar?
You know, I don't know. Actually, that's a good question. No one's ever asked me that question before. I never thought about it, but I think drums is just, as you're a kid, I must have seen someone hit a drum set before, and you kind of go, wow, that's cool. I do know that my mom had told me that I used to grab the broom for whenever Elvis would come on the radio, and I would strum the broom, you know, a broom.
There you go.
Yeah, but drums, I just think that I must have seen somebody hit a drum set before, and I can't remember who or where. You want to hit something like that.
And she actually threw him out the window.
When one of those moms didn't play.
I love it.
TV. Don't hit those drums. I'm trying to watch TV. Okay. Hit the drum. Hit the drum again. And if you hit the drums one more time, they're going out the window. And she didn't make idle threats.
I love it. That's classic. What was your first break in the business?
It depends on what level break.
Gotcha. Well, when you first started playing out, how old were you?
17, I think. 16, 17.
Oh, wow. You're young.
Yeah.
So did you, like, start a band way around town and then
I played with guys at with the high school with. There was a band called the Chiefs back then, and their guitar player, I want to say his name was Ricky. For some reason, he couldn't do some shows, so they asked me to learn some of the songs and try and play them. And I remember the Romantics, What I Like About You. Was that the Romantics?
Oh, yeah, that was Romantic. Yeah,
and I can't remember else. That was like just, I remember that. Then I was in a band on Long Island called Courier that was playing Rush cover tunes. And then I convinced them we should just do trio bands because, you know, if you play 40 Rush tunes, only guys come see you play. So I was doing Police and Zebra and Triumph as well as Rush. I like Rush, but 40 Rush tunes pretty much ensures that mostly guys come see you play. You know, around that too, little bands, stuff like that. There are different things. I just can't remember all that.
So how long were you in the business before you got your big break?
I'm still not sure what the big break is.
Well, I mean, you've become the accolades you have. I mean, to play with all of these big cats and these big names and to produce and to win these awards, and something must have, there must have been a transition that went from I'm playing with a local band and then all of a sudden here I am, you know, in the music business with a label, backers, things like that.
I don't know if there's a real overnight success thing. I've been playing for a long time. All those things you mentioned happened over time.
Right, but was there something that kind of just, there was that one, you met that one person that got you a gig, that got you the next gig to get you to the next level of playing?
Yeah, see, I was playing around Manhattan all the time. I was playing a band called Rhythm Team, and then I started playing with lots of different people. In fact, I didn't realize until later on I was playing with 9 different bands at the same time.
There you go. Okay, that's what I'm thinking about. It had to be something that just all of a sudden, boom, you're there.
Well, it didn't seem like all of a sudden. It's like, you know, you play with a bunch of bands for 3 or 4 years. And then Carmine Rojas was looking for a guitar player. Carmine. He was looking for a guitar player to play, do a Miguel Bosé tour in Spain and Italy. I didn't know Carmine. He didn't know me, but everybody else seemed to be already in the road. All the people that he knew seemed to be already in the road. What I believe, and I see Carmine a couple of times a year, I run into him. What I believe happened was he went to all the clubs, like the China Club, Nirvana, and all the clubs that he used to go to, and would ask about who's in town, what guitar players, what bass players, because he wasn't playing the tour, but he was putting together the band. And I believe he said that my name came up in the first 3 names at every club that he mentioned.
Wow, that's awesome.
So then he contacted me, and which is funny because my grandmother talked with him, and my grandmother was famous for not giving me messages.
I remember those days.
The kids today don't understand. You didn't have your own personal cell phone. You might have had a beeper.
That's
then you had to find, like, a working phone or something like that.
That's right. In New York City, I was tough those days.
Yeah, Carmine finally, he persisted and called, and I did that tour. And I came back from that tour and played around New York City a little bit more. I put together my band, and I got a record deal in 1990. And, and before that, I had heard about an audition for Billy Squire. And I auditioned for Billy, had a great time with the band, but I did not get picked for the gig. But in 1990... they were auditioning two guitar players again, and I happened to run into those guys at the China Club. Strolled in the China Club, saw the whole guy, you know, Billy and the rest of the band there. I was like, wait, you guys live at far ends of the corners of the earth from each other. What are you all doing in one spot? Told me they were there looking for guitar players and stuff like that. I wished them well, and before I could get up, Billy said, what are you doing? You're coming on the road with us. And I was like, oh, okay.
Nice. I just had Alan on the show the other day. Yeah, it was great to catch up with him. It's been a while.
But
you got into producing. How did you do the crossover?
I had worked with a couple of singers, songwriters in the mid-90s, and then been on 4 different labels, or by then maybe 5 different labels, and was not happy with the way things were going, so I had decided that I could, well, before I decided I could do it on my own, a friend of mine said I needed to make a new record. Like, yeah, I could budget to make a record, and people aren't making records on their own back then. And he had gear in his basement. He goes, you can use the keys to my house. You can use it. So
wow.
I went down there. I made phone calls. Some amazing people stopped and helped me, stopped what they were doing and helped me figure out how to use the gear. And so I made 2 records. One was awful that never got released. And the other one was my acoustic record, which has been extremely well received. And that was by accident, totally by accident. But when that record came out and I was doing well with it, I had decided I could do stuff on my own. And I wasn't going to sign another record deal back then. And of course, the record industry is very different now. But a few years later, I had moved to San Diego, California, and I bought recording gear. And I was working on another record. I had met some singer-songwriters in San Diego that wanted help with a song here and there, so I would do that. And then a year later, I'm still working on my record, and they were coming back going, well, they really liked the song I did, and they had worked with other people to finish their record, and they weren't happy, so they wanted me to finish the record. So before I could finish my record, I found myself working on other people in San Diego's records. And before I knew it, I was producing a few records, quite a few records. And then I moved to Brooklyn for a year to work with my friends, the Berman Brothers and Jeff Copeland. And where I wasn't doing so much production, I was working with them. They were producers. I guess I did some stuff, but under their guides. And after a year and a half of being in the pop world, I decided to want to go back to just regular singer-songwriter. The artist that I had produced, her name was Eileen Meyer, she was ready to do her second record, and by then she had moved to Santa Fe, New Mexico, so she said she wanted to do another record, couldn't move to Brooklyn to work on it with me there, and I said, well, I'm kind of tired of being here, so I can come to Santa Fe. I was supposed to fly to Santa Fe on September 11th, 2001. Took me 2 weeks to get out of New York, and when I got there, I didn't want to leave, so I was
nice.
In New Mexico. Yeah, I was in New Mexico for 10 years.
Oh, wow, that's a long
there.
Time.
Yeah, produced some cool records there, and that definitely solidified me as a producer, being in New Mexico.
That's astounding. I mean, it's really great to know that you can get, as you say, a lot of bang for your buck. But, you know, here you are starting out as a guitarist and playing guitar and making a living doing that. And then to make transition to also have another skill added to the, you know, repertoire is a beautiful thing. Like, it's so important to be multi-talented these days because, you know, if you can't find work in this arena, maybe you can find work in that arena. So you have to be able to juggle and really dip your toes into a bunch of different areas just to see, you know, what you're good at, because sometimes you don't know until you try it, and then you're like, oh, wow, look at that. I can do that.
Yeah, you know? I actually believe that you have to be able to do lots of different things because, like you said, I've definitely had times where people are calling me as a sideman, and then they stop. And then maybe there are festivals and shows that want me as an artist, and then they stop. And then production times, I've been an engineer, spoken at college. I taught at a college for a year, taught recording techniques. College Santa Fe. You have to just roll with it and do lots of different things. And it's fun. It makes it balance is the key thing. I've been working on balance probably about the last 7-8 years, which is like I don't want to do too much of just my thing as an artist because that's stressful. I don't want to do too much as a side person because I enjoy that, but I still want to do some of the songs I write and play. I like producing records, but I like working with artists that I really enjoy, and no one's got budgets. You know, people aren't they don't have big budgets for records these days, stuff like that. So I might as well take my time and pick the artists that I want to work with, at least make sure they're nice people.
That's phenomenal, and that's so important.
Yeah, you just want to do different things and stuff like that, but a balance of it, not too much of anyone.
So speaking of new things here, I mean, you have a new release of your album called The Traveler. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
The Traveler, I went back to the last record, has quite a few players on it. The record before that, Sonic Temple, has no extra players on it. It's just kind of all me. So this one goes back to that. There is one other player, Dawn Avery. She's a cellist, a Native American Mohawk descent cellist that I produced several records for, and I love the cello. I had played keyboard strings and programmed keyboard strings, and I was talking to her. She goes, "Well, send me the tracks. I'd love to play, you know, playing it." So she doubled some stuff. She added different things here and there. And so she's the only other person on the record. I'm totally digging it. Not just because it's my newest record. I just really dig it. It's got songs. It's got at least 4 songs I've been playing live with my trio for the last 2 years. I had done a streaming only EP of 4 songs. So there are different versions of those songs to you from a year and a half ago.
Great idea.
Yeah, you get to feel out. So some of them are slightly different tempo. I think I got it together on this version of the record. And then there are a couple of songs. There's a song that's kind of in the Peter Gabriel vibe. I don't know. It's just it's a cool record. It's not a full-on blues rock record. There are songs on this record that in order for me to do live, I would have to have the keyboard player and stuff like that. So when I play in different areas of the country, I have a keyboard player. Like when I go to Italy, there's a keyboard player that's going to be playing with me. So I can do some of those songs with lush pads, and it's just a bit more mellow and kind of groovy thing.
Well, I'll tell you, your show the other night was so much fun watching you play, and I love the way you play when you play with one hand, and that's just really impressive. And I was just like, I'll be doing it.
Playing with one hand for many, many years, but I didn't. It's progressed over the years. There is a song where I could probably play almost the entire song with one hand. And I don't know. It's just progressed over the years. I probably did it in the very, very beginning for performance value kind of thing. But then I started doing it for sound because it's different attack when you pick it and when you not pick. And I've done it because I've played stuff and I'm working like when I record and I'm by myself, so I'm doing one tweaking, turning knobs, the other hand's playing the part. So
I love it. You're multitasking. That's great. It looks phenomenal, you know, and you're watching it, and it sounds amazing. So I'm just like, wow, that's really cool.
Precious.
It definitely is, and I think it's probably one of your trademarks.
Okay, cool.
What would you say is maybe one of your, like, biggest challenges or roadblocks that you might have faced while you were in this business called music?
Interesting. Interesting question. Well, things are changing. The music business is changing daily. But I'd say that more so in the old days, people would judge you strictly by appearance before they even listen to your music. It used to be a quicker thing. Like if you let status quo the so-called music business norm get to you, then you're doing yourself a disservice. Because I remember I had turned 30. This guy who I thought was a friend of mine had started working at a big major label, and he called me up and said, "Hey, what are you doing now?" And I said, "Well, I'm trying to figure out. I'm doing the record. I'm trying to do this, do that." He said, "Why don't you come in and play me some of your demos?" So I went to his office, played some demos, and then he proceeded to tell me how I was getting older, and I might want to consider different things. And
I played to
perfect, and I should try and play the type of music that was going on at the time, which was like
grunge or something.
Yeah. Play a little bit less out of in tune and all this stuff. And I was listening to, what are you talking about?
Wow.
And, it at first, but then I was like, wow, 30, I'm over the hill. Okay. So I think that still obviously exists if you're trying to become a pop artist, country pop artist, rap artist, whatever. Those have seemed to be two things making money these days. But the world is very different. So can be a 65-year-old artist. You make art that people want to hear. All you have to do is find your audience. They're out there. And they're easier than ever to find and easier than ever get to and get them your music.
I love that. So when I'm touching on that point right there, like, what's your favorite social platform? Do you use social media?
Yeah, I've been using Facebook well. I try to use Twitter. I'm not great at it. I try and use Twitter. Fortunately, there's quite a few people that will take what I put on Facebook sometimes and put that on Twitter. I guess I should be doing that more, but I haven't done it. And YouTube's amazing. I mean, if YouTube was around when I was going to high school, I don't know if I would have graduated. There's so much lost in that. You know, I'm just going to look on YouTube for 10 minutes.
I hear you on that.
Yeah, I was doing a sideman gig once, and I was in San Diego, and we just finished soundcheck, and the singer turned to me and goes, "Do you know Fragile by Sting?" I'm like, "No." Okay, and I said, "All right, hold on a second." So I take my iPhone out and Google how to play Fragile by Sting, and 8 things came up right away on YouTube, and I learned how to play it.
Isn't it amazing? It's just, it really
wow.
is. It's...
I don't know if I really would have left the house back then,
You have a really good point there. I mean, I'm blown away by how far we've come with technology. And I think I just say to myself, gosh, it's the same thing. If we had this like 25, 30 years ago, I would be like, sitting really nice right now.
That would
have been
really
nice. That too. But I think I would have had a totally different life. Not that I'm not complaining. It just took me a lot longer to get to where I wanted to go. Have you ever had any embarrassing moments on stage?
I had my one moment of stage fright on the Miguel Bosé tour where they kept teasing me because I was running around the stage like crazy. They said, "Aren't you well, nervous? You never did a tour this big before." We did a 90,000 person show.
Holy moly.
In Spain, there were like 20,000 and 40,000 people at shows. And we were playing in Madrid and they were recording it. That show is actually on YouTube too.
What's it called? I'd love to check it out.
Miguel Bosé Live. I'll send you a link. I can't remember what it's called, but it's Miguel Bosé Live in Madrid. But the beginning show, all right, so we went to Italy, and we rehearsed for, I think, a month and a half. We learned a bunch of songs. There were 3 Americans, Warren McRae, Alan Child, and myself. And then everybody else was either Italian or Spanish. And we learned the songs in Italian. Not that we spoke Italian, but the set list was in Italian. And they'd say the name of the song, and we, after a while, you knew what it was. Get to the first venue in Spain, the Plaza de Toros, bullfighting ring, and
wonderful.
It was in Madrid. Get on stage, look down. Now, we didn't play this exact same set every night. There were, a couple of different start possible, stuff like that. A couple of choices. Get on stage, everybody's going to go crazy, wait for Miguel to come on. I look down, and I don't recognize a song in the set. I go, "Warren, what's the first song?" He goes, "It's, I don't know." Alan, what's the first song? Alan was like, "I don't know." So we called the Italian musical director, and we asked him what the song. He tells us in Spanish. He goes, "Yeah, that doesn't help." I look at the Italian. He's looking at us like, "What?" So we go through that, do the first song, second song. Now, there are cues. Like, a lot of times if you work out a show, you'll see, like, the artist, maybe the band will do, or the artist will do 3 songs, and then they stop and talk to the audience. And it could be anything, but there might be a cue word that means they're done and get ready to start the next song. And a lot of people have been doing that for shows all the time. Like, you could talk about anything, but then you got to wrap it up with something that says, blah, 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 cue for the next song. So I remember he's speaking in Spanish, and I have no idea what he's saying. So he's talking to the audience, and I'm going, "I still don't know what the next song is." And as I look up, there's a camera guy in front of me. There's 7 cameras on stage. Camera guy in front of me. And then I look to the left, there's a camera guy. Camera guy walking towards me. And then I look to the right, and I can see from a distance there's a cameraman going, "I definitely start this next song. I just have no idea what it is."
That's too much. I would have freaked out.
There is my moment of stage fright. And Miguel obviously said, during that time, I forget what's going on, Miguel obviously says the magic word in a language I did not understand. And I have no idea what the first song is. And they're looking at me like, yeah.
That's so embarrassing.
I have no idea.
I would have cringed.
I would think Enzo realized what was going on and either started or told me what was going on.
That's a great story. So tell me, Larry, are you ready for the 11-stroke roll rapid fire interview?
The what?
The 11-stroke roll rapid fire interview. I ask you 11 questions.
Okay.
Quick question. Okay. Oh, your favorite guitar?
My new Nag Severin guitar, made in America, made in Maryland.
Love it. Your favorite food?
I'm not a big food person. Toss up between bacon and sorbet.
Mm. Your favorite band?
That's a tough one. I am a huge U2 fan and a huge Prince fan. You mean band, not artist, not solo artist?
No, either or.
I'm going to say the most influence, the most, when I go to artists I go to, tough times, it's got to be Prince.
Cool. Your favorite song?
Wow. A toss-up between Purple Rain and Sometimes It Snows in April, Prince, both by Prince.
And your favorite travel spot?
I love Salzburg, Austria.
Oh, pretty. And your favorite person to hang out with?
That would get me in trouble. I have lots of friends. I don't know if I have a favorite.
Tranquil spot.
It used to be, when I lived in San Diego, California, used to be the Self-Realization Garden. You don't have to be a member there, but they open it every day. I think it's a Monday. You can just kind of go there and meditate and chill, and right on the ocean. Lately, I've been bike riding, only when I've been home. Although I did ride when I was in Venice Beach, California. But I have a bike, and I try and get up 7:30, 8 o'clock when I'm home and ride before it gets way too hot. And I just discovered through a friend Robert Trent Golf Trail, and right behind my house is basically the Grand National. And it's beautiful.
That sounds beautiful.
Yeah, it's just very cool. So.
Car or motorcycle?
Dine-in
or take-out? Oh, cool. Those are fun.
Yeah, I love my car. I am probably more a take-out and eat it at home on the couch watching TV or while I'm working.
Cool. Your favorite tour?
Tour that I've done?
Yes.
If it's not my own, it's a toss-up. Tracy Chapman tour in 92 was really great. It's almost what I expected, but not. Yeah, I mean, you can't expect everything, but it's not what I expected. The Billy Squire tour was a full-on rock and roll tour. Like, almost anything you think of like a rock and roll tour would be was on that tour. I mean, we shared a hotel with Alice Cooper's band.
Say no more.
Yeah. And, you know Greg Smith?
No, I don't.
Greg Smith's a bass player from Long Island. He played bass back then with Alice Cooper, so it was great to see him on the road. We both played a festival. We played a blues festival, and I remember Alice Cooper walking in and going, do these people know what I do? Because he was on a blues
I love
festival.
That. Yeah, that just doesn't seem like the place for him to be.
he did the full-on Alice Cooper show, too.
He did? How did that go over with the crowd?
Oh, they loved it. It was cool.
Oh, cool.
But on, like I said, on the Billy Squire tour, I mean, we played the Raceway in Oklahoma for 20,000 people. It was full on rock and roll craziness. It was great though. At the beginning of that tour, I had done a record with Rick Ocasek, and was supposed to go out on a big tour with Rick, the big tour didn't happen. We just did like promotional stuff, and. So I asked Rick and his manager, I said, hey, Billy Squire wants me to do this tour. It's only 6 weeks, which turned into 6 months.
Wow.
So I said, do you mind if I go out? Well, you know, yeah, sure, we're not going to go out. And, you know, we got plenty of time. I think it was right before the first show when they called and said, hey, we want to do a video for this song, Rockaway, that you played a solo in, that you played on. can you come back for that? And I was like, uh-oh.
Oh, wow.
So, and,
so what did you do?
I talked to Billy, and he was not happy about it, but he's like, go ahead, do it. Just don't miss any shows. So, but wait, so this is actually, this choir tour had to be my favorite tour because this is my 2 weeks of living like a rock star. And I mean living like a rock star, not being a rock star, but living like a rock star. Because before, when we were working that out, they also said, there's now a show with Rick Ocasek at Montauk for the Billy Joel Paul Simon Lighthouse benefit.
Oh, wow.
And can you do it? I'm like, So everything lined up perfectly. The day they were shooting the video, we had 2 days in a row off. The day that we played the Lighthouse benefit, I want to say it was originally the day we were supposed to play the Meadowlands with Bon Jovi and a bunch of people, but we ended up not doing that, so they never filled that date. So we had a Saturday off.
Wow.
Which was really...
That's a rarity.
And the next day, because again, they had routed the tour to go through the Meadowlands, the next day, Billy Squire was supposed to be playing over the Hamptons.
Oh, I was at that show, yeah. That was a show.
And you were at the Squire show?
I was.
Oh, wow. Okay. So basically, we had a show someplace, I can't remember, and then we had the Saturday off, and I played with Rick Ocasek in Montauk, and the next day was the Hamptons with Billy Squire. But when I say the 2 weeks of living like a rock star, I had to rehearse with Rick Ocasek for that. So
oh,
for
wow.
2 weeks, they worked it out. So for 2 weeks, any time that the Squire band had a day off, I would stay in that city, and at 6 a.m. or so, a car would pick me up and take me to the airport. I would fly to New York. A car would pick me up and take me to SIR. I would rehearse with Rick. And then the car would take me home. The next day, the car would pick me up and take me back to the airport, and I'd fly and meet the Squire wherever they were. And I would do sound check and the gig. I did this for 2 weeks. And
wow. Talk about burnout.
Yeah, I had no sleep, too. I forget what airline it was, but it was, I kept flying in and out, and we were definitely in the East Coast, so I think that might have been like the Carolinas, and I can't even remember. I just found the tour book too. I should look at that. but I would run into some of the same flight attendants, and they'd be like, "So what do you do?" Because I didn't have to bring any gear either.
Oh, that's
guitar.
Sweet.
And I remember someone leaning up and going, "Who do you play guitar with?" And I said, "What day is it?" Coming to New York or coming from New York? And they were looking at me like I was nuts. I said, "Well, if I'm leaving New York, I'm playing with Billy Squire tonight. If I'm coming to New York, I'm rehearsing with Rick Ocasek." And people thought I was nuts. And then the final day, I flew into New York, and I refused to do the helicopter, which would have got me at Montauk really easy. But
very quickly, yeah.
My then girlfriend, Diane Russo, was in the car. And we end up at Montauk, and I'm playing on stage with Rick Ocasek playing some Cars tunes. And on one side of the stage is Paulina Porsakova, supermodel number one, videotaping. On the other side of the stage was Christie Brinkley, supermodel number two.
I love it.
I could definitely deal with this. This is a different kind of lifestyle. And then the next day I played with Billy, and that was all back to normal. And I was like, I felt so, wow, I'm not flying anywhere.
That's a great story. I love it.
That was an interesting time. Probably my favorite. There was all kinds of crazy stuff that happened. Like I said, Tracy's story was great, but kind of normal. It was great. As normal could be.
What would you say is your biggest pet peeve?
Pet peeve? I don't know. Could be that, like, a lot of times when arranging shows, like I just did a show, I won't say where it was, but I had never played a new club, it's big, and when we booked the show, they contacted me, and then at some point in the negotiation, they said, oh, the owner doesn't think it's going to work, but they contacted me to do the show, because the person that books the show had seen me play, and it was a great show that they saw. I mean, great, as in the response and the amount of people is just tremendous. And then they came back and said, the owner doesn't think it's going to work if two sets of all instrumental music. Remember? And I was like, okay, so you don't really want me to do the show. I said, no, we want you to do the show. We'd just like you to have a singer, a part of the show. And I was like, what? So they, so I said, well, you know, I can bring a singer in, a singer that I used at the show that they saw me. So they agreed to pay extra money to fly this singer in because they didn't think that it was going to work. But meanwhile, they wanted me to do my normal show, which seemed really bizarre.
That's twisted. Yeah.
And when we did the show, it was a really great time. And I'm glad we brought my friend out because it just worked out really nicely at the show. But after talking with them, it totally would have worked if it was just my normal instrumental show. Absolutely would have worked. And they realized.
And that's kind of nervy to ask the artist to do that if, you know, you're asking for one thing and then, oh, by the way, let's just change the show.
Yeah, I was actually ready to not do
like,
it. What we did was we brought my friend now, John Kersley. He's a, oh, you saw John.
I saw John. That was awesome.
Yeah. So basically what we did was we did my show and then in the middle of it, I broke it down to acoustic and then I handed that position over to John. He played one of his songs, a couple of his songs, and then we played a couple of his songs electric and then we continued from there. But so it was fun, but it totally would have worked the normal way. But it's okay because they paid extra to bring John out, and I'm glad they did because it was a good time. I've had that before. I've had people go, well, I don't understand how it's going to work instrumental. And my response has been lately, well, then not even entertain the idea.
Right, if they can't handle it.
Yeah, but they don't think it's going to work. And then when we do it, they go, oh, this does work. It's not like I'm going up and just making up tunes on the spot and jamming and stuff like that. I have 8 albums of instrumental songs.
Of great music, exactly. So, yeah.
I work on the melodies and stuff like that. I love having people sit in and sing. It's a little bit more pressure when you say, well, you have to bring somebody, something like that. You know, I've gone to places and people show up at the shows, and I'm like, oh, we got to get you on stage, you know. And it's great. I've realized from, you know, just like you, from the New York days, that I know some amazing musicians. In fact, we know people that the world considers some of the best in the world.
Absolutely.
So when they're there, you're like, oh, you got to, you know. If I'm at a show and Alan St. John is there, I'm going to be, Alan, let's find a keyboard. You got to play something or sing something because Alan can sing.
Oh, yeah. He's really good.
Oh, yeah.
He's really good. So do you have any words of wisdom for those that are looking to break into the business?
You have to be strong. It's still a business where many people don't think you can do it. The word do it is redefined daily. So you have to figure out what you want, what doing it and what making it means to you. I don't know if you notice that there aren't many multi-platinum artists every month. In fact, there's a few artists that go platinum a year. Whereas there are many people that I know that have gone platinum and their record was considered not a success because it didn't go as platinum as their record.
Multi-platinum, right.
So there are only a few people that actually go platinum these days. It's a different business. Like I said, different business. You have to figure out what success means to you. Is it something you absolutely love to do? I always say that, you know, doing this is just like opening a restaurant. You have to constantly be working. And if you're not, when you're not working, you're thinking about, you know, the future. And you're thinking about, it's on your mind all the time. It's like, yeah, you have to work.